Hello, this is Chris with the Champaign News Gazette for Monday, December 4th. We'll begin today's reading on the front page. Bus service blasted for bigoted email. Three U of I leaders decry ads insulting reference to China, from Champaign. Three campus leaders on Sunday condemned a private bus service for making what they called offensive, bigoted, and insulting statements to try to drum up business over Christmas break. Sparking the outcry, an email from the company to its customers, including University of Illinois students, that read in part, "You won't feel like you're in China when you're on our buses." Some 6,000 Chinese students are enrolled at the U of I. It's 12,454 international students in 2016-17, were the sixth most of any U.S. college, according to the Institute of International Education's annual Open Door study released last month. A statement co-signed by three U of I officials blasted Champaign-based Suburban Express on Sunday, saying its messages are in direct opposition to the values of this university. The message specifically insulted members of our Chinese, Asian, and Asian American communities, who are a vital and valued part of every aspect of both the University of Illinois and our local cities. These types of racist and bigoted statements attacking any members of our community deserve nothing but condemnation from all of us, read the statement, signed by Vice Chancellor of Student Affairs Danita Brown Young, Director of International Student and Scholar Services Martin McFarlane, and Vice Provost for International Affairs and Global Strategies Octokane Makola. The three emphasized that the U of I has no business relationship with Suburban Express, adding that the company's buses are prohibited from picking up or dropping off passengers on university property. On Sunday night, Amusha Tharaka, president of the Illini Democrats, told the News Gazette her organization is also organizing a boycott of the company. "It is really appalling to see that kind of advertising in this day and age. This is racist in any definition of the word. We call upon the people to exercise their right to refrain from patronizing this company." Suburban Express owner Dennis Toppin did not respond to requests for comment and did not answer the door Sunday afternoon and evening at the address listed on his most recent traffic tickets. However, his company released what it called an apology over the weekend. "This remark is being interpreted as a slap in the face of all non-Caucasians for some reason, and that is not how it was intended." It went on to accuse the U of I of mismanagement, saying they admit large numbers of international students who pay higher tuition. Nearly 20% of the U of I students are natives of China, and this high percentage of non-native English speakers places a variety of burdens on domestic students. "We agree that having a healthy mixture of different cultures and ethnicities is valuable, but we're not comfortable with the idea of selling our university to the highest foreign bidder." Said the Cora, "I think the so-called apology is worthless." Chinese natives expressed their own concerns about Suburban Express on the U of I quad on Sunday evening. "I rode a Suburban Express bus one time and felt quite uncomfortable with the experience. Now I hear these comments from the Suburban Express. I came to America out of affection for the United States. Apparently, some American citizens don't think the same about us." Wei Wang of Who's on China said she was willing to forgive Tappan for his comments, but I don't think I will ever ride one of his buses again. Is death penalty likely to be sought versus Christensen? Previously, Sessions supported it. Federal prosecutors have until February 1st to determine whether they'll seek the death penalty for accused kidnapper and killer Brent Christensen, a decision that will ultimately be made by U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions. By all accounts, Sessions is a supporter of the death penalty, but experts say how involved attorneys general get in the process and whether they let their personal views affect it varies. "It depends," said Paul Charlton, a former U.S. attorney in Arizona, "and it depends on the attorney general." Under Attorney General John Ashcroft, a George W. Bush appointee, Charlton tried a death penalty eligible case that he didn't think warranted capital punishment. "I was able to convince Ashcroft not to, and he agreed," Charlton said. "I spoke with him personally." Under Ashcroft's successor, Alberto Gonzalez, Charlton tried another case that he didn't think had strong enough evidence to seek the death penalty, especially since investigators didn't have access to the victim's body. In my particular case, he supported the death penalty, and I was fired for objecting. On December 7, 2006, Charlton was one of seven U.S. attorneys asked to resign, a scandal that eventually led to Gonzalez's ouster. Charlton had been an assistant U.S. attorney in Arizona since 1991. He became a U.S. attorney in 2001. He said some attorneys general he worked with were very involved in the process and others weren't. People like John Ashcroft, who supported the death penalty, was very much involved in the process, he said, as was Janet Reno, who personally opposed the death penalty but sought it when appropriate. There were others who weren't very much involved, like former Attorney General Gonzalez, who relied heavily on the Capitol Review Committee for their recommendation. And it may be too early to tell today where Sessions lies on that spectrum. When it came time to rule, Ashcroft said Ashcroft and Reno were able to put aside their personal views on the death penalty and make objective decisions. Both Reno and Ashcroft, anyone who worked with them would say they were fair and impartial in which cases to seek the death penalty. Gonzalez was not. As Texas Attorney General, Gonzalez gained a reputation for a very aggressive view as it relates to the death penalty and a light review. More often than not, he was in favor of seeking the death penalty. In federal cases with charges eligible for the death penalty, the local U.S. attorney will submit a recommendation to the Assistant Attorney General. From there, a Capitol Review Committee will analyze the case and meet with the defense attorneys and representatives from the U.S. Attorney's Office before making a recommendation to the Attorney General. The final decision about whether to seek the death penalty rests with the Attorney General. Among the restrictions prosecutors face, they're not allowed to use the death penalty as a bargaining chip. While plea deals can be sought with the Attorney General's approval, the death penalty may not be sought, and no attorney for the government may threaten to seek it, solely for the purpose of obtaining a more desirable negotiating position, according to the Justice Department's U.S. Attorney's Manual, which lays out the confidential process. Says Charlton, you shouldn't charge and seek the death penalty unless you truly and genuinely believe taking another life is the right punishment. Also, as part of the process, the U.S. attorney is supposed to consult with the victim's family about the decision of whether to seek the death penalty, then pass that on to the Justice Department. Urbana attorney Steve Beckett, who represents the family of the visiting Chinese scholar Christian is accused of kidnapping and killing, said Yingying Zhang's relatives have submitted their views in writing to the U.S. Attorney's Office. A document was drafted that reflected the family's view and was sent to the U.S. Attorney's Office to be forwarded to the committee, declining to disclose the family's wishes. That would be confidential. I don't think I should comment on that. Sharon Paul, spokeswoman for the local U.S. Attorney's Office, said she doesn't know how far along the process is to decide whether to seek the death penalty. Christensen's attorneys declined to comment. The Attorney General's office did not respond to questions about Sessions' involvement in the process or his views on capital punishment, instead referring the News Gazette to the U.S. Attorney's Manual. Over the years, Sessions has defended the death penalty and its constitutionality. All I know is that he was very pro-death penalty, and there is no doubt in my mind that he is still very much for the death penalty, said Hank Sanders, an Alabama state senator and lawyer who testified against Sessions during confirmation hearings to become President Donald Trump's attorney general. As a U.S. senator from 1997 to 2017, Sessions regularly defended the legality of the death penalty during hearings and speeches, noting that the U.S. Constitution regularly refers to capital crimes. Within the very corners of the Constitution itself are the multiple references, six or more as I recall, to the death penalty. It talks about capital crimes, Sessions said in a 2003 speech, according to a transcript from Vote Smart. And in 2012 speech, he said, "A lot of good people with very plausible arguments, I don't agree with them, but I respect them, say we should not have a death penalty." John Donahue, a Stanford law professor who wrote an op-ed in the New York Times titled "Jeff Sessions, the Grim Reaper of Alabama," argued that Sessions repeatedly fought to uphold death sentences against insane, mentally ill, and intellectually disabled people as Alabama's Attorney General from 1995 to 1997. Donahue expects the number of federal death penalty cases to increase under Sessions. "I suspect that it will," he told the News Gazette. "Certainly it sets a tone, even if the Attorney General doesn't directly weigh in. I think Sessions certainly represents a point of view that would encourage the relevant prosecutors to be more sympathetic to the use of the federal death penalty." During his confirmation hearing, Sessions said he wouldn't let his personal or philosophical views affect his enforcement of U.S. laws, citing a case in which he dropped the death penalty when his appellate lawyers and the local community sought it. "They said it didn't have the aggravating factor you needed to carry out a death penalty, and I said we can't go before the Supreme Court and argue for a death penalty if it doesn't meet the standard for a death penalty," Sessions said. "That turned out to be an easy decision to make that day, but when I was running for the U.S. Senate maybe a year later, it became one of the biggest ads and biggest attacks on me." Beckett, who has been involved in six death penalty cases, said he'd be surprised to see the Attorney General overrule the Capitol Review Committee's recommendation. "The process would be pretty meaningless if the unique personal principles that one has as an individual has for or against capital punishment were to come into play." Beckett could see the Justice Department going either way. "Would I be surprised if it was judged to be a death penalty worthy? No. Would I be surprised if it was not found to be death penalty worthy? No. Every case is based on its own facts." Robert Dunham, the executive director of the Washington, D.C.-based Death Penalty Information Center, said capital prosecutions are relatively rare. "There are thousands of murders in the U.S. every year, and there will be in the range of 35 death sentences this year," adding that it's virtually impossible to predict what is deemed worthy of being a capital case and what is not. When the Attorney General signs off on seeking the death penalty, the government files a notice of intent. The number of such notices peaked during the George W. Bush administration, according to data on the Federal Death Penalty Resource Council's website. About 20 notices were filed per year during the Clinton era, when Reno was Attorney General. That increased to almost 30 per year during the Bush presidency and dropped to less than 10 per year under the Obama administration. While ideology plays a role, the number of death penalty cases have been shrinking at both the state and federal level for years. The rate at which the death penalty is used is declining over time at the federal level. We saw a decline during the course of the Bush administration, and we saw a continuing decline during the Obama administration. Certainly, ideology had something to do with it, but the decline mirrors a similar decline that we've seen in the pursuit of the death penalty at the state level. Also on the front page, Me Too impact hits close to home. As the curtain keeps getting pulled back on sexual misconduct involving high-profile figures in media, entertainment, and politics, the effects are beginning to hit home. "It's like a floodgate of belief has opened," said Adeline Amazi, executive director of Champaign-Urbana's Rape Advocacy, Counseling and Education Services. "I can't stress how helpful that is." October's allegations of sexual harassment against movie producer Harvey Weinstein set off the so-called Me Too movement, with social media users posting that hashtag to signal that they too have experienced sexual harassment, assault, or violence. Among the latest to speak out, the Reverend Leah Roberts Moser, pastor of Champaign's Community United Church of Christ, who shared her story of an encounter with Garrison Keillor in the wake of related accusations against the humorist and radio personality. A longtime fan of his, Roberts Moser, said she and her pastor husband, David, attended a one-man Keeler show in Michigan 10 years ago. Afterward, they waited in line with other fans to tell Keeler how much they enjoyed his Prairie Home Companion shows. When I got up to him, I introduced myself by saying, "Hello, Mr. Keeler. My name is Leah, and I'm a pastor, and..." He cut me off. "You're a pastor?" he said. Then he reached up and pulled the lapels of my jacket shut to cover my cleavage, in the process touching her breasts. Sharing her story, Roberts Musser said, led to a phone call from a crying woman thanking her. "I've believed since I was a teenager that silence is complicity. And today her phone call confirmed it. Speaking out and speaking up matters. If we lined up all the potential acts of sexual harassment and abuse on a spectrum, my experience with Mr. Keeler would rank very low. But even my kindergartner will tell you that you're supposed to keep your hands to yourself." The Me Too movement is also prompting more people, the majority of them women, to go public with their allegations of sexual harassment by powerful men. The list grows longer almost every day, and some careers are ending in the process. While more people speak out, Ami said her center hasn't had more clients, but morale is changing. "Our survivors are thinking, wow, they're finally believing us. So many of our survivors locally run into the same things we're seeing nationally. They report and it's not believed, or it's swept under the rug." Building off the movement's momentum, Amy also launched a racist public awareness campaign in January, with advertisement slated for billboards and buses. She said making connections outside Champaign and Urbana is important. "One group on our mind is people in rural areas. It's so much harder for them to get help. It's a hike to get from Rantoul to here, so we're trying to help with transportation. A $10 gas card can help someone get to counseling a few times." At the University of Illinois Women's Resource Center, Director Sarah Cologne said there have been more explicit requests recently for sexual harassment training. The WRC trains groups and departments throughout the university, as well as outside organizations. Cologne said every workplace should require sexual harassment training, and it's time to rebuild workplace culture as a whole. She noted that there are laws protecting those affected by sexual harassment and violence, but they're not always put into practice. "Harm can be perpetrated by anyone. I hope all entities take it upon themselves to say they'll do the hard work to make sure people feel safe, even if it means facing hard truths." Sexual harassment training requests have also increased at Vermilion County's Rape Crisis Center, according to Tara Wright, Prevention Educator, Outreach Awareness Director, and Sexual Assault Therapist. "This time last year was a lot slower than where we are now. Funding was a big concern last year, but now we have more and aren't worried about keeping the lights on at night. Progress in the post-Weinstein era shouldn't be measured by the number of men losing their jobs. Instead, Cologne sees success as a public understanding of the individual, interpersonal, and systematic accountability behind each allegation. The cultural trope of boys will be boys, for instance, is one thing Amy would like to take down. That attitude does a disservice to boys and men. It sends the message that you're a prisoner to your biology." Miracle menorah on its way from Champaign. Rabbi Tovid Tikal calls it the miracle of Hanukkah. Less than 2 months after vandals for the fourth time in 3 years damaged the cherished menorah that stands outside the Chabad Center for Jewish Life on campus, a unique and sturdy replacement is on the way, with plans to unveil it a week from Tuesday. "We're hoping we will have it lit for the first night of Hanukkah, December 12th, said Benjamin Bross, lead architect of the project. "The concrete will be poured Tuesday on a Jewish symbol that's quite unlike the ones that preceded it. It will be taller, 9 feet, heavier steel reinforcements, and something Tikal hopes becomes as much a part of the commencement photos and Illini game days as Rosh Hashanah and Rom Kippur. On one side of the structure will be the traditional menorah symbol. on the other the black eye. This menorah was created with a vision. The vision is a message of light. The menorah is carved into the sculpture, and the space is going to be filled with different lights on different occasions, whether it's orange and blue for an Illinois basketball game, or white or blue in honor of Israel, or red, white, and blue in honor of the United States. Bross was sold on Trickle's idea from the start. It was the rabbi's vision that he wanted to make sure people understood it wasn't just about the Jewish life. It wasn't just about Illinois. It was about Jewish life at the University of Illinois and how that Jewish life could be part of a larger community. Tikal would rather not focus the attention on the vandalism cases, the most recent of which happened on October 27th when two students broke off one of its branches and were caught on surveillance video doing so. Said the rabbi, life's about moving forward. And from Crime Stoppers, police ask for tips in shooting death. Champaign County Crime Stoppers and the Champaign Police Department need help finding the people responsible for the shooting death of a Champaign man last month. About 4:10 a.m. Saturday, November 25th, police were sent to the 2500 block of West Springfield Avenue where they found Martrell Johnson, 28, with a fatal gunshot wound to the chest. He was in a parking lot at the Country Brook Apartments. Police have learned that while the shooting occurred outside, it stemmed from an argument that took place inside a nearby apartment. Detectives need to speak with anyone who was present or who may have photos, video, or any other information regarding the shooting. Anyone with information is asked to contact Detective Ben Newell at 217-351-4545 or Crime Stoppers at 217-373-TIPS. Crash victim identified from Urbana. Champaign County Coroner Dwayne Northrup said no autopsy will be performed on a Brownstown woman who died following a crash Tuesday on Interstate 57 in Effingham County. Northrup identified the victim as Shirley M. Klitzing, 83, of Brownstown. According to a state police report, Ms. Klitzing was driving southbound in the northbound lanes of Interstate 57 in Effingham when she hit a semi-tractor trailer driven by Richard P. Meserve, 68, from Mayer, Arizona, head-on at 10:28 p.m. Saturday. The force of the collision threw Ms. Klitzing's car around the truck. The truck then overturned and hit a guardrail. Both drivers had to be cut from the wreckage of their vehicles. Northrup said Ms. Klitzing received multiple traumatic injuries in the crash and was airlifted to Carle Foundation Hospital, where she was pronounced dead at 12:44 a.m. Sunday. Mr. Meserve was pronounced dead at the scene of the crash. And from Champaign, courts look for Mayan interpreters. Immigration courts in central Illinois are struggling to effectively represent people who only speak an indigenous Mayan language. About 550 people in the Champaign-Urbana area speak the language, according to the Chicago Tribune. Guatemala's language has more than 20 indigenous Mayan languages. The National Immigration Center says there has been an increase in Jaloban-speaking immigrants over the past 8 months. The language was the 17th most popular language in immigration courts across the U.S. in 2016, up from the 25th place 2 years prior. Two other indigenous Mayan languages, Mam and Quiche, were in the list's top 10. Ashler Hubner, an attorney for the National Immigrant Justice Center in Chicago, a program with the Heartland Alliance that provides legal assistance to immigrants, said the lack of interpreters impedes attorneys' ability to fully represent these individuals and for these individuals to have access to protection. The government is required to provide interpreters for defendants in immigration court hearings. Interpreters for the Mayan language are often flown in from other parts of the United States. And from the local page, Tom's Mailbag. I live off of Airport Road in South Savoy, and recently a large, very bright light has been erected in what appears to be Dana Colbert Park, north of my home. The light is so bright that it lights up my children's rooms, and I have to draw the blinds in order to get them to bed. What is this light, and is there a reason it is so bright and on all night long? The light appears to be coming from a parking lot at a small shopping area east of the Savoy Walmart on US 45. I talked to store owner operators there who said new parking lot lights recently were installed because they had been complaints that the lot was too dark. The property is owned by the Lenovia, Michigan firm identified as SFP Pool 6. I called the business and was told they'd look into your complaint. The University of Illinois solar farm, located south of Windsor Road between Neal and First, has been offline since October 29th and hasn't produced a watt of electricity for a month now. What is wrong? The solar farm went offline October 29th, said Steve Bretweiser, the manager of communications and external relations at the U of I's Faculties and Services Department. After the array have experienced a malfunction with the on-site electrical system that supplies the inverters. Phoenix Solar South Farms has worked to address the situation since it was discovered and is currently performing repairs. The university signed a 10-year power purchase agreement with Phoenix Solar in 2015 to receive all electricity produced by the solar farm and deliver it directly to the campus grid. Phoenix Solar is responsible for the operation and maintenance of the array for the duration of the arrangement. The company anticipates the installation's renewable electricity production will resume by the end of the year. The traditional color for fire hydrants is red, but the hydrants in my neighborhood are orange. What does the color of the hydrants in CU indicate? Also, how often are the hydrants inspected and painted? In the Champaign County service area, Illinois American Water-owned hydrants are painted orange. Illinois American Water has over 4,300 fire hydrants in the local service area, which are inspected annually. They are painted on a 4-year cycle. The Illinois Commerce Commission requires private water utilities to maintain and inspect fire hydrants. We work closely with our local fire departments to ensure hydrants are meeting their needs. The hydrants owned by others should be painted red. In Peoria, Illinois American's hydrants are yellow, and the private hydrants are red. And from Philadelphia, new approach to restricting rules. A group of Democratic voters from Pennsylvania is trying a new argument in a push to have the state's congressional maps redrawn. They want a panel of judges to rule that the districts cannot be created to favor one political party. The case is set for trial in Philadelphia this week. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Champaign News Gazette for Monday, December 4th. Please stay tuned.